Now, the Olympics are going on right now. If you've been watching over the past 2 weeks, I don't know how you feel about the Olympics, but I absolutely love the Olympics, probably more so the Summer Olympics than the Winter Olympics, but I love everything about the Olympics. I love listening to the stories of the athletes and how they got there, the road that they had to travel to even make it to the Olympics, whether it is watching curling. Whoever thought curling would be exciting, but for some reason during the Olympics, it's very exciting. In the summer, who would have thought ping pong is exciting to watch? But if it's in the Olympics, it is just an amazing time to support Team USA and just support the Olympics. But every time the Olympics come on, one thing for me personally that I'm reminded of every time the Olympics comes on, specifically in the summer, is I was not good enough to go. That's my first thought when the Olympics come on. Somewhere when I was age 10, I had the dream planted in my heart and head that I wanted to go to the Olympics. And so for the next 14 years, I organized my entire life around training and preparing for the 1996 Olympic Games. And from the age of 10, so that would be middle school through high school, I trained about 6 hours a day. I was a swimmer. That's the sport that I happened to be decent in. And so for middle school, high school, trained 6 hours a day. After I was done with high school, I moved to New Jersey, and I trained with one of the best coaches in the country for an entire year to give me one more year before I went to college. And then when I went to college for 4 years, trained 8 hours a day. And then after my 4 years of eligibility was up, I moved back to my high school coach to train with him in preparation for the Olympic trials. And the Olympic trials come around in 1995. And in 1995, the way the Olympic trials work in most sports is they have a time standard, and you have to meet that time standard to go to the Olympic trials. Now, they usually set it so high that there's only about 20 to 25 people in the country that will make it per event. And so for my event, I was a sprint freestyler. It was my final opportunity to make the time trial cut to go to the trials. Keep in mind, I'd been training for 14, 15 years with one goal in mind. And I had taken so much of my life just focused on this one thing since I was a little kid. And in my final race, I missed that time standard by 7/10 of a second. And I remember my coach coming up to me saying, "Michael, we can do this one more time. Do you have anything left? We can do this." And I said, that was it. Everything I had was in that race. And I remember that night very specifically. It's about 2 a.m. Had no idea what to do. My dream that I had chased for 14, 15 years was completely dead and completely over. And I remember the only thing that was open was a CVS. And I remember sitting on the floor of a CVS next to one of their coolers, crying my eyes out. And the CVS worker said, "Sir, are you okay?" And I remember having a conversation with this CVS worker about I had nothing to live for anymore. I felt so empty. I felt so alone. Everything that I had pursued and chased was completely over. I did not know what to do. Now, when I think about the Olympics, and if you were to ask me, "Michael, why did you train and drive so hard to get to the Olympics?" It was really for one reason. Now, I didn't say it like this because it sounded too prideful, too arrogant, too egotistical, but the one reason that I really trained and purposed my life around the Olympics was I wanted to be great. I wanted other people to see me and recognize me and applaud me and notice me, specifically in swimming, but I wanted to be great. Now, the question I wanted to ask, is it wrong, is it bad to have the desire to be great? Is it a bad thing to desire to be great? And this might sound prideful to say, "I want to be great," but doesn't it sound equally odd to say, "You know, I just want to be mediocre. I want to be a mediocre husband. I want to be a mediocre wife. I want to be a mediocre employee or student or son or daughter or friend." So is it wrong, bad desire to say, "I want to be great"? Now, this might sound shocking to you, but I'd say the desire to be great is not wrong. What is wrong is how we actually understand greatness. So I wanted to ask you the question before we get going, how would you currently define greatness? If someone were to ask you, "Hey, how do you think about greatness?" How would you answer that question? What words, what adjectives come to mind when you are thinking about greatness? I'm guessing words like power or prestige or influence or titles or degrees, fame, fortune come to mind. Who do you think of as great? Like when you even think about people that you know, whether personally or just from afar, and you think, gosh, that person is great. They have achieved greatness. What people do you even have in mind? I'm guessing maybe for some, if not a lot, we think of athletes, or we think maybe of actors, or we think of activists, or we think of maybe artists, or we think of politicians or musicians or people who have been successful in their business careers. Now, if you want to understand how you even currently define greatness, just look back to the words you used and think back to the people that came to mind when you heard about greatness. And that's a good picture of how you would currently define greatness. Now, in my pursuit to be seen as great, wanting to be noticed, wanting to be applauded, wanting to be recognized, the world's definition of greatness, it led me to pursue something so much less than what actual greatness is. And when I got to the end of it and realized what I was chasing was the wrong thing, it left me completely empty. And what I would love for all of us to see as we look at Mark chapter 9 specifically is biblical greatness is worth pursuing. Biblical greatness is worth pursuing. There is something within all of us that desires to be great. None of us wants to be mediocre. None of us wants to be average. But what happens is that desire for greatness gets very quickly twisted. A book that I was reading through with some of the leaders at the church where I serve called Garden City. The pastor said it like this. We want to be great. The problem is this desire becomes quickly warped and soiled and bent out of shape by ego. We devolve from a desire to be great to a desire to be thought of as great. From a desire to serve the weak to a desire to be served by the weak. From a desire to save the world to a desire to actually have it. We've lost sight of what biblical greatness is. But again, my hope, my heart for our time today is the beauty of redeeming biblical greatness is that people would actually see the greatness of God in that. As you and I would become men and women that would pursue biblical greatness, in that, people would actually see the greatness of God. Now, two questions I wanted to ask and hopefully answer this morning from our text in Mark. Question number one is this: how did Jesus define greatness? How did he define greatness? And then question number two is, how might we apply Jesus' definition of biblical greatness just to how we live? And how you live every moment of every day with every person that around you in your home or in the place of work or in your place of study, how might we apply his definition of greatness to every aspect of our lives? Now, if you had a few months to spend time with Jesus, you and your friends had a few months just to spend time with Jesus, and you actually got to see and be witness to everything that Jesus was saying, everything that Jesus was doing. You got to see firsthand all of the miracles that Jesus was performing, the incredible impact that Jesus was having. I'm guessing that you would begin thinking, you know what, we're hanging out with greatness. In light of everything that Jesus is saying, everything that Jesus is doing, at some point you would begin thinking to yourself, we are in the midst of greatness. We are hanging out with greatness. In Mark chapter 9, listen to something Jesus said in verse 31. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of his enemies. He will be killed, but 3 days later, he will rise from the dead. Now, if you were that group of people hanging out with Jesus, seeing the great things that Jesus was doing, and then you heard Jesus say that, what would be some of the questions that you think you would begin to talk about amongst yourselves? Again, you and your friends are watching Jesus do all these great things, and then you hear Jesus say this, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into his enemy's hands, and he will be killed. What questions do you think you would begin asking? Why on earth would this happen to Jesus? Why would anyone want to kill greatness? Now, I don't know if that's the questions that you think you would be asking, but if you heard Jesus say what he said, wouldn't some of us be asking Jesus, how could this possibly happen? Why would anyone want to do this to you? As soon as verse 31, Jesus says this is what's going to happen to him, this is what the disciples began talking about amongst themselves. This is Mark chapter 9, verse 32. Verse 33. After they arrived at Capernaum and settled in a house, Jesus asked his disciples, "What were you discussing out on the road?" But they didn't answer because they had been arguing about which of them was the greatest. As soon as Jesus tells them that he is going to die into the hands of his enemies, be brutally murdered, the next conversation that these followers of Jesus begin to have is, who amongst them is going to be the greatest? Now, to me, that is somewhat mind-boggling that you can go from hearing Jesus say that to then talking about, but which one of us is going to be the greatest? Now, I'm thinking they, along with us, lost sight of what true greatness is. Now, you would think that Jesus would either rebuke these disciples, that he would criticize these disciples, or he would even condemn these disciples for arguing about who amongst them would be the greatest. But what Jesus does actually next reminds us that desiring greatness is not the problem. It is our understanding of greatness that is the problem. Jesus says this in the very next verse, verse 35. He sat down, he called the 12 disciples over to him, and he said, "Whoever wants to be first," and that word first is also can be translated as great, "whoever wants to be first must take last place and be the servant of everyone else." Let me read that one more time. He sat down, he didn't condemn them, didn't criticize them, just calls them to himself and said, "Whoever wants to be first must take last place and be the servant of everyone else." So in light of what Jesus just says right there in that one verse, how might we begin to understand greatness? Would anyone here a few minutes ago have defined greatness as a last place servant? Would any one of us have used that language of, gosh, when I think of greatness, I think of a last place servant? That's not how I initially think about greatness, not through the lens of a last place servant. I think what Jesus is doing for them, I think what he's doing here for us as well, is he's giving us more than just words to understand greatness. What I think Jesus wants us to see is this: Jesus is the definition and demonstration of true greatness. If you want to understand greatness, Jesus is the definition. It's not just words we use. He is the definition of greatness, and he is the ultimate demonstration of true greatness. Now, in the verse that I read, in verse 31, you heard Jesus refer to himself as Son of Man. This is a self-designation term that he used throughout the gospel narratives. He would often call himself the Son of Man. Now, Son of Man is certainly a claim to his humanity, but there is something more when Jesus says he is the Son of Man for us not to miss is what Jesus is saying about himself in this title, in this designation. Jesus is saying, the Son of Man, I am the Exalted One. Now, if you go back to the Old Testament, specifically in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel has a vision, a picture of the Son of Man, and this is what he says. "As my vision continued that night, I saw someone like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven, and he approached the Ancient One and was led into his presence. He was given authority, honor, and sovereignty over all nations of the world so that people of every race and nation and language would obey him. His rule is eternal. It will never end. His kingdom will never be destroyed." So in light of who Jesus says he is, the Son of Man, the one who has all authority, all honor, is sovereign, and will rule and reign over an eternal kingdom, Jesus says this, the Son of Man, he became a last place servant. The one who is fully man, but fully God, the Exalted One, becomes a last place servant. So let me ask this question. What does it really mean to be a last place servant? I think when we even hear that language, last place, that means we're just supposed to give up and let people get ahead of us in a race, as it were. How would you define what a last place? What does it mean to be last place? The Apostle Paul is someone who met Jesus and his life was forever changed, and he wrote much of the New Testament that we have. And in Philippians, a letter that he wrote to a young but growing church, this is how he defined or talks about being a last place servant. In Philippians chapter 2, starting at verse 3, don't be selfish. Don't try to impress others. Be humble, thinking of others as better than yourselves. Don't look out only for your own interests, but take an interest in others too. You must have the same attitude that Christ Jesus had. Though he was God, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges and took the humble position of a servant and was born of a human being when he appeared in human form. He humbled himself in obedience to God, and he died a criminal's death on a cross. What does it mean to be last place? Last place does not mean that you don't care about yourself. It just simply means you don't make everything about you. My question would be, how much of what you do today, on a day-to-day basis, is done so that you'll get noticed? How much of what you do on a day-to-day basis is so that somebody in your life will recognize you? How much of what you do just on a day-to-day basis, home, work, school, is so that you would be applauded? Whether in home, school, wherever it might be, how much of what you do is done so that other people will notice you and who you are? Now, social media, for all of its good things that it can do, what it has is created is communities of people screaming, "Would you please notice me?" Every Facebook, Twitter, Instagram post is largely driven by, "Would you please notice me? Would you notice what I am doing?" Now, the problem with living in hopes to always get noticed is that you don't notice everyone else around you. If you are living in such a way where you want to be noticed, appreciated, applauded, then the problem is you're so concerned about everyone else looking towards you that you're missing everyone else around you. Greatness is not about our position, is not only about our position, last place, but it's also about our posture, namely being a servant. Again, if Jesus is the definition of greatness, throughout his ministry, he also demonstrated what greatness looks like in being a servant to all people. I don't want you to miss what Jesus said in verse 35. Whoever wants to be first, be great, must take last place and be a servant of everyone else. Please hear this. Jesus does not tell us to serve. He tells us to be servants. Jesus does not tell us to serve. He tells us to be servants. Not everyone who serves is a servant. But if you see yourself first and foremost as a servant, well, then you will always be someone who is serving. There are many people who serve just because someone asked you to serve. There are many people who serve just because there was a need and you were willing to meet that need. There are some who are willing to serve just because it makes yourself feel good. It makes yourself feel important. So I want to serve because I like that feeling that I get. Well, what happens when that feeling goes away? What happens when there's not a need? What happens when no one asks you specifically to serve? Well, you'll stop serving. So I ask you a challenging question. I ask myself a lot, Michael, are you just one who serves or are you actually a servant? There's a tremendous difference. Are you one who just serves or are you see yourself through the lens of a servant? Now, just being totally honest with you, I'd rather serve. I'd rather serve because it's much easier. I'd prefer just to serve when it's comfortable, when it's convenient, when it fits my life, my time schedule. It's so much easier just to serve. But biblical greatness is not seen in serving, but in being a servant, because servants will always serve. Now, this is the next question. If you are a servant, then you have to begin asking the question, well, then who do you serve? Who are the people that you and I are called to serve as servants? And I love how Jesus just made this clear with one word. Everyone. Everyone. Verse 35 again, whoever wants to be first must take last place and be the servant of everyone else. Everyone means all people, not just people who look like you, not just people who think like you, not people who dress like you, not even people who believe in what you believe in. Everyone means absolutely everyone, that there would not be a person in your life that you could ever declare, I am not going to be a servant to that person. Jesus often taught using hyperbole, exaggeration. And I think he wanted to make sure his disciples were not confused. It didn't come to this conclusion of talking amongst themselves, I bet everyone doesn't really mean everyone. He's just exaggerating here. And so to make sure that they did not make that conclusion, Jesus gives them an example in verse 36 and 37. Then he put a little child among them. And taking the child in his arms, he said to them, anyone who welcomes a little child like this on my behalf welcomes me. And anyone who welcomes me welcomes not only me, but also my Father who sent me. Children in the first century, very marginalized, very neglected, very much ignored. They had no rights, they had no privileges, they had no power, they had no priority, they had no prominence. And so Jesus' point here, I want you to be a servant to those that can't advance your name. I want you to be a servant to those who can't advance your career. I want you to be a servant to those who just can't advance your position. I want you to be a servant to even those that will have no impact whatsoever on your pocketbook. I want you to be a servant to those that others would not ever even consider serving. And I think for many, this is where it might be very easy to say, all right, you know what? I'm just going to go start serving in a local sober home. I'm going to go serve in a local soup kitchen. Again, that is not bad. But again, there is a tremendous difference in serving and being a servant. Greatness is not seen in serving. Greatness is seen in being a servant to everyone. I think what Jesus wants us to understand is be a servant where you are, not where you're not. Be a servant where you are today, not where you might be tomorrow, but where you are today. Be a servant to those that you work with every single day. If you think of us, if you have a job and you're working somewhere 35, 40, 50 hours a week, 50 hours a week, you have the opportunity to look at the men and the women that you are around that much to say, I'm going to serve you because that's who I am. I am a servant. Be a servant to those that you study with. For those of you that are in school, high school or college or grad school, how much would this change if you begin looking at your professors and faculty and fellow classmates through, gosh, I am here not only to learn, but I'm also here to be a servant to the men and the women that I am with a lot. Be a servant where you live, in your own home, to your own husband or to your wife or to your kids or to those that you live around in your neighborhood. So serving in the soup kitchen, serving in a sober home is certainly important, but greatness is not going to be seen in just serving in those moments, but being a servant specifically to all people around you. Now the question that I wanted to finish with this morning is, how do we apply biblical greatness? If biblical greatness is worth pursuing, and it is, and if Jesus himself is the definition of what greatness is, and he demonstrated greatness for us, well, how might you and I begin to apply biblical greatness to how we live every moment of every day? And this might sound strange, but if you can remember this, if you want to know how to apply biblical greatness, it's a cup of water. As simple as a cup of water. Immediately following Jesus teaching his disciples on what biblical greatness is, the disciples are immediately concerned. The next thing that happens as soon as Jesus uses this child as an illustration to be a servant to everyone, the disciples are immediately concerned with someone else becoming great. The very next verse in 38, it says, John, one of the disciples, said to Jesus, "Teacher, we saw someone using your name to cast out demons, but we told him to stop because he wasn't in our group." It's amazing to me that Jesus is just giving a very profound teaching on what true greatness looks like. And the very next thing that happens that these disciples are so concerned about is someone other than themselves casting out a demon. They were afraid that someone else might appear or become great that was not with them or one of them. Now, if you take time later this afternoon to read all of Mark chapter 9, you're going to find that the story that precipitates Jesus' teaching on leadership is the disciples are actually trying to cast out a demon and they can't. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the disciples are saying, "We wanted to stop him because we don't want him to be seen as great in doing something that we were not actually able to do ourselves." Clearly, as soon as Jesus taught on biblical greatness, they still did not understand biblical greatness. And so Jesus gives them a clear example. Guys, this is what it's going to look like to apply biblical greatness to your life. Mark 9, verse 41, "If anyone gives you even a cup of water because you belong to the Messiah, I tell you the truth, that person will surely be rewarded." What is the work worthy of a reward from God? What is the one thing that God says, if I'm going to give a reward, what is that work that is worthy of a reward from God? It is a cup of water. That to me is absolutely amazing, that it's not the work worthy of a reward from God is casting out demons or doing the big, big, big things that we think are so worthy of a reward from God. Jesus says it is giving someone a cup of water. If you belong to the Messiah, if you're a Christian, if you're a follower of Christ, then biblical greatness will be applied, will be seen, will be demonstrated in giving a cup of water. Now, last question for you would be this. As you think about the men and women in your life that you live with, live around, men and women that you work with, who in your life right now needs you to bring them a cup of water? Who in your life right now needs you to bring them, because you're a servant, just your willingness to give them your time? I want to spend time with you. I want to sit with you. I want to get to know you. Who in your life right now just needs you to come alongside as a cup of water and say, "I want to help"? However I can possibly encourage or help you, who in your life right now needs you applying biblical greatness to just simply bring them a cup of water? My heart for this text this morning was that we would see that Jesus is the definition of greatness, and his entire life was a demonstration of greatness. The Son of Man, the Exalted One, became a last place servant, not just to some people, but to all people. Jesus redefined greatness for us in his person, and Jesus demonstrated greatness for us in being a servant. My heart for the church I get to serve, my heart for Joey and his church here at Restoration Road, is that we would be men and women who actually pursue biblical greatness. It is not a prideful thing, it is not an egotistical thing to say, "I want to pursue biblical greatness, and I want to apply biblical greatness to every aspect of my life." Just know that biblical greatness will be seen in you taking last place and you becoming a servant, not just serving, but becoming a servant to all people. And this is the beautiful gift, that when you pursue biblical greatness, the men and women that you give a cup of water to, they will actually get to see Jesus, who is the definition and demonstration of greatness.